purposes of this case, it should be very clear that at both the trial court level, as well as at this court level, Mr. LaPlante has not disputed State Farm's right to make a claim for reimbursement of some of the MedPay benefits out of Mr. LaPlante's settlement. LaPlante has always conceded that. While the current Colorado statute now prohibits such reimbursement, and other states' public policy prohibits such reimbursement, that is not the issue in this particular case. State Farm, in this case, cites numerous cases arguing that it has the right to some reimbursement, and then they say that that means that they have a direct right of action or direct subrogation. On that issue, let me first say, and I have two simple main points. Number one, the right to some reimbursement is entirely distinct and a different question than the right to collect 100% of the claim without any offset for the benefit that State Farm received from Mr. LaPlante's recovery efforts. That's a different question. State Farm says, well, we asserted our own direct claim and we had the right to do so. Even if that's, and my second point is the legal issue, but even if that's true, even if State Farm has the legal right to assert its own direct and independent tort action against the tortfeasor for recovery of its subrogation, there is still a disputed question of fact as to whether it did so before LaPlante had already done all the collection work to get the case in a position to settle.
Mr. Castle, yes. What fact actually is disputed?
Good question. There is a dispute about whether the collection actions of Mr. LaPlante benefited State Farm. That's the factual dispute, I guess, because that's disputed. But there isn't much dispute about the actual facts. And that is my point, is that even if there was a direct right of action, there's still a overwhelming undisputed evidence that Mr. LaPlante did the following things before State Farm did anything.
Before you get to tell us what those following things are, I just want to clarify about the disputed issue of fact. Since you said in answer to my question that there really don't seem to be disputed issues of fact, so are you saying really that it's just a question of interpretation of those facts that we're dealing with?
No, not exactly. What I mean to say is that there are certain facts that are undisputed and that nobody really contested, and I can list those. But the question that is disputed is whether under those facts that are undisputed, whether those facts established that clearly or not, State Farm benefited from Mr. LaPlante's recovery efforts. State Farm says we didn't benefit from Mr. LaPlante's recovery actions, but there's no dispute about what Mr. LaPlante did. State Farm says we pursued our own claim directly and independently, but there's no dispute that they didn't take any action to make that claim until after Mr. LaPlante had already presented the medical bill claim to Nationwide and is already in the throes of negotiating a global settlement that included those claims. I don't know if that's the distinction. So, because if State Farm benefited from Mr. LaPlante's recovery actions, there's no dispute, everybody in the case agrees, that the common fund doctrine would apply and that State Farm should have to pay its pro rata or fair share of the fees and costs and expenses incurred by Mr. LaPlante. So what were those activities that Mr. LaPlante engaged in? He obtained, organized, and provided to Nationwide, the tortfeasor's carrier, detailed itemized coded medical bills. Second, he gathered and provided to Nationwide the supporting medical records for all the billed treatment. Third, he gathered and provided medical records to Nationwide for a prior injury that Mr. LaPlante had been involved in because Nationwide was requiring the production of all those prior accident records in order to evaluate the claim. In addition to those three things, which are, I don't believe there's any dispute about that, he also provided liability information to Nationwide, and Mr. LaPlante also hired an attorney, and naturally by hiring an attorney and getting involved in the case, there was a communication to Nationwide that the claim was going to be made and that this was going to be pursued. So, in the same time that Mr. LaPlante did all of what I just said, there's also no dispute that State Farm did not do anything to pursue reimbursement of its claims. In its affidavit to the trial court, at the record at page 207 and 208, it admitted that it hadn't submitted any information to Nationwide on its medical bill reimbursement claims. Secondly, in its trial court brief, State Farm, at the record at page 190, said they admitted that they had not done anything and that nothing was done until after Mr. LaPlante was globally negotiating the case. Yes?
Mr. Kent.
Sure.
Isn't it so, though, that State Farm, fairly early in these proceedings, sent a letter to Nationwide saying we've got a right to this money?
It is correct that early in the case they sent a letter saying, generally, we believe your client is at fault and we intend to pursue subrogation. There was no mention in any way of MPC MedPay reimbursement subrogation claims.
I understand that, but didn't your client at about roughly the same time receive a letter from State Farm that specifically informed him that they were going to be seeking MPC subrogation claims?
That he did get a letter saying that they would be seeking subrogation in the sense of reimbursement. That letter does not say that we are going to pursue our claim independently and separately and you don't have to worry about it and you don't have to take any action or do anything. The letter doesn't say that. And in fact, in their policy, they admit there are two different options that they claim that they can elect. And one is what they call subrogation. The other is reimbursement. And they at no time told Mr. LaPlante that he didn't have to worry about them because they were going to go do their own thing and his settlement would be completely separate and he didn't have to concern himself for that.
So I want to make sure I understand the issue as you framed it before us today.
Yes.
You're not arguing with State Farm's right to get some reimbursement.
That's right.
The issue is, in your mind, how much of that approximately $25,000 should come your client's way. Is that correct?
That's correct.
What's the number?
Well, it has to be decided by the trial court for two reasons. One is the trial court has to decide the factual question after a hearing of how much benefit they obtained from Mr. LaPlante's efforts. The fees and costs are roughly $6,000 to $7,000 would be their fair share. In addition to that, there's the question of whether there was a discounted settlement that they should have to participate in the discount on a pro rata basis.
Thank
so
you.
That can't be decided, and I can't state that. That's a trial court.
Thank
fact.
You.
Mr. Castle, one
yes.
thing that I've been wondering about is that when State Farm sent a letter to either you or Mr. LaPlante that said, we're not going to provide any money to you under the common fund doctrine, and you argue in your briefs that that was inconsistent with State Farm's own policy manual, do you know why, or is there anything in the record that indicates why State Farm indicated that in its letter to you?
No, because there wasn't any discovery, so discovery was stayed. That questions were never asked of any State Farm personnel.
discovery was effectively stayed during the whole case. As soon as the motion was filed, there was a stay of discovery motion. The second point in my final few minutes is that the right to some reimbursement is distinct from the right to pursue its own separate independent tort action for collection of bodily injury damages like medical bills. And State Farm wants to assume that they have it because there are cases that talk about subrogation. There are no cases in Colorado that support the concept that they or any insurance company who paid medical bills has the right to go independently and separately, directly prosecute its own tort claim unless there's a statute directly on that point.
What about the D. Herrera case on which Judge Marshall yes. relied?
D. Herrera is the closest case, and that's because it's also an MPC, MedPay, Auto MedPay. In D. Herrera, there is critical distinctions. First of all, the bill payer, American Family Insurance, did not attempt to pursue its own direct action. The plaintiff, D. Herrera, had pursued the action and had already settled the claim. So the dispute in D. Herrera was just whether American Family was going to get a share in that settlement proceeds. There wasn't a question whether American Family could go out and prosecute its own case. Secondly, in D. Herrera, Mr. D. Herrera tried to deny American Family any recovery whatsoever. They said, you can't get anything of our money. Third, in D. Herrera, Mr. D. Herrera, in his settlement agreement, in his release and settlement agreement, had explicitly in writing promised to pay American Family. Based on those facts, there was no argument, no consideration, no discussion of whether American Family had an independent right of tort action against the tortfeasor. And that distinction is true of all the other cases that they cite. There is no such distinction. And with that, I'm going to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Very well, Mr. Castle. You have just under 2.5 minutes.
Yes.
Good afternoon. My name is Thomas Seaman. My registration number is 4172. Our law firm represents State Farm in this matter. I'd like to address the made whole aspect of this case first. And one of the questions that the court asked of Mr. Castle, I think, bears some discussion, and that is, how is the number determined in terms of what State Farm is entitled to recover following Mr. Castle's theory that this issue has to be litigated? And he hinted at the idea that the trial court would have to make a determination in some sort of a hearing as to not only what State Farm was entitled or obligated to pay as costs and attorney's fees, which is really not made whole. That's the common fund aspect of it. But he also said the court would have to determine the extent or degree to which the plaintiff had succeeded or been made whole in his settlement with the tortfeasor. And that's not what is going on here. What was requested in this case and what was scheduled in this case was a jury trial. And what the plaintiff envisions in terms of pursuing that is to try his damages, which have already been, you know, compromised and settled against the tortfeasor and against the liability carrier, and panel a jury, put on all the evidence of damages, have that jury make a determination of what the damages total is, compare that determination to the settlement amount, and then apply that percentage of success, if you will, to State Farm's recovery. So, for example, Mr. Castle's proposal is to have a jury decide the issue of damages, and if the jury decided the plaintiff's damages were $190,000, which is twice the $95,000 that was paid by the tortfeasor's liability carrier, including State Farm's $25,000 MPC subrogation claim, under that theory, the jury would have decided that the plaintiff was entitled twice what he recovered from the liability carrier. State Farm would then have to reduce its recovery of its subrogation interest by one half, And that $12,500 would be paid to the plaintiff under the theory that the plaintiff is espousing. That makes no sense to us at all, Your Honors. The idea of settling cases is to settle them once and for all and not settle a case against a tortfeasor and a liability carrier and then go off and try the case to a jury so that you can determine how much of the subrogation claim is going to be recoverable by the MPC subrogated carrier.
Mr. Seaman, as an alternative to that, though, I mean, you could look at it as a case where there was a settlement request for $115,000 and the ultimate settlement was $90,000. Is that not a possible way of determining a pro rata recovery?
I don't think so, not realistically, because there are all sorts of negotiations that go on. What if the opening demand was for $1 million, which was the policy limit in this case, knowing full well this wasn't $1 million damages case, but let's say they demanded $1 million and they settled for $90,000. Does that make $1 million some sort of a measure of what the plaintiff's damages are in terms of determining whether or not the plaintiff was made whole? And that's the other issue that the court needs to maintain sight of, and that is that the fact that in this case there's $1 million in liability insurance coverage available to the tortfeasor. And in entering summary judgment in this case, the trial court, Judge Marshall, made a specific finding or comment. He said plaintiff was free to negotiate his settlement and assert the full value of his non-subrogatable or non-subrogated claims without any interference by State Farm. He was also free to proceed to sue the tortfeasor. So the idea that the plaintiff was not made whole because he accepted a settlement of 95 and State Farm got 25 of the 95 makes no sense when you consider the fact that there was $1 million in liability coverage and the plaintiff ultimately settled for less than 10% of the liability coverage. There aren't any really strong, direct, made whole cases in Colorado, but there are a couple that we cited, in fact, were cited by the plaintiff in their brief. Those cases are the Marquez and the Crawl cases. And we would acknowledge that in some instances, the courts in Colorado have applied equitable principles to say that subrogated insurance carriers have to take a back seat, if you will, to their insureds in pursuing their subrogation claims. And that situation occurs when there's a limited amount of insurance coverage, and arguably there's not enough coverage for the injured insured to receive fair and full compensation for his injuries and damages. So Marquette and Crawl are those fact patterns, but that's not the fact pattern that we have here, where there's $1 million in liability coverage, an agreement to settle for less than a tenth of that, and then to have the injured insured come back and say, even though I settled for 95 and I netted 70 out of the 95 after State Farm received its money, I haven't been made whole because I've still got further uncompensated injuries and damages, and I want to go off and try that damages case to a jury and have that jury decide what my real damages are, notwithstanding the fact that an arm's length negotiated settlement had occurred, and then use that as some sort of a measure to determine how much of the subrogation interest is recoverable by State Farm. There's just no law to support it. It doesn't make sense, and it's bad public policy, frankly, because it would invite litigation of cases or claims that have already been settled by compromise.
Pardon me for interrupting, Mr. Seaman, but would you please address De Herrera? And in doing so, could you please address the distinctions that Mr. Castle raised that say that he feels mean that De Herrera doesn't apply to this case?
I think what Mr. Castle is arguing, and it applies to De Herrera, it also applies to Osborne, and I would argue that De Herrera and Osborne both support the concept of the right of a direct and independent action brought by the subrogated insurance carrier against the tortfeasor or against the liability carrier. What Mr. Castle is arguing is that because the insured in that case, De Herrera, had already pursued and settled a claim against the tortfeasor, that American Family, which was seeking to enforce its subrogation right, you know, somehow not able or allowed to bring a direct action. The key language that I think you have to look at in the Herrera case is in the case of this recognition of a direct right of action is in the opinion in V. Herrera's written by Judge Lowe. He states, this is on page 350 of the decision, that under the doctrine of, and there they were talking about equitable subrogation, here we have contractual subrogation. When an insurer has paid its insured for a loss caused by a third party, it may seek recovery from the third party. And it cites the Cotter Corporation case. It says, in such an action, the insurer stands in the shoes of its insured. So I think D. Herrera does recognize the right of a direct action. It just didn't happen in D. Herrera because D. Herrera had gone off, pursued a claim, settled a claim. The settlement included the subrogation interests of American Family. But if D. Herrera or if the American Family had chosen to do so, they could have pursued that action on their own, independent from their insurer, because they had that right under the subrogation. And there was equitable subrogation, and the court still recognized that right of direct action. In Osborne, there's a contractual subrogation clause. And again, in Osborne, the Court of Appeals, the panel had heard that case, not only recognized that right of direct action, but they pointed out that in that right of direct action that belonged to the insurance carrier, they had a right to arbitrate, as State Farm does in connection with Mr. LaPlante's medical payments coverage claim. So in other words, insurance carriers in Colorado, for the most part, I'd say probably better than 90% of the claims between insurance companies, are subjected or submitted to arbitration if the two carriers can't work it out. In Osborne, which was a PIP subrogation claim, and it was one of the rare cases under the old PIP statute where there was a right of subrogation, because most of the subrogation rights were done away with by the statute, but there were some exceptions. State Farm and Osborne had that right, direct right of action, independent from its insurer, to pursue its subrogation right, and the Court of Appeals in Osborne said that if we were to do away with that, we would be depriving State Farm of its right to arbitrate that dispute if they can't work it out with the liability carrier.
Mr. Stephen, could you respond to Mr. Castle's arguments under the common fund doctrine that State Farm should pay part of his attorney's fees because State Farm really didn't do anything to recover?
I think State Farm did what it needed to do to recover, and I think that this court, again, I think the leading case with regard to common fund in this context of insurance subrogation is the Osborne case. And if you compare State Farm's actions in Osborne, which the court in Osborne found sufficient to establish that State Farm was not a passive beneficiary of this common fund, but was actually actively pursuing its subrogation claim, the same sorts of activities existed in this case and were recognized and identified by the trial court in its ruling on summary judgment.
Let me ask you more specifically, though. Here, it's apparently undisputed that Mr. Castle gathered the medical bills and presented them to Nationwide before State Farm did so. And I think that's the thrust of his argument that the plaintiff is entitled to some recovery.
I apologize for interrupting, Your Honor. I don't think the court should read too much into that timing issue just because of the nature of the subrogation and the way it's exercised between carriers. Once the liability of carrier is placed on notice that State Farm, as an MPC carrier, is paying medical expenses and seeking subrogation with regard to those medical expenses, then generally the two insurance companies look at that and the assumption is that the with regard to that piece of the claim, the medical payments piece of the claim, that the insurance company, the liability carrier is going to pay that, is going to look for, you know, the amount of those medical expenses at the appropriate time. They're going to honor that subrogation claim, or if they dispute it, they'll arbitrate it. But it's not a situation where in order to be an active beneficiary, State Farm has to immediately start submitting medical bills, medical records, all of that. For one thing, State Farm is not going to pursue its subrogation claim until, or for the most part, in most cases, aren't going to pursue that claim until they're insured has decided what the insured wants to do with his own claim. I don't think State Farm wants to, you know, jump in or interfere with any activity or action. And they became aware at a certain point that Mr. Castle was pursuing that claim. But I think the key is notification to both the liability carrier and to its insured that they were pursuing, going to pursue that claim and do so independently. And when they got a letter from Mr. Castle saying that he was submitting a demand and, you know, putting State Farm on notice of that, they immediately responded to Mr. Castle and said, told him that he was not to pursue or was not authorized or expected to take any action on behalf of State Farm, and that it could and would pursue that claim independently from the insured. So I just don't think the fact that, otherwise I think you would create a situation where sort of a race to see whether the insured or the MPC carrier can get to the liability carrier first with whatever documents in order to establish that right to reimbursement under the common fund doctrine.
So are you suggesting then that Mr. Castle should not have sought a comprehensive settlement from Nationwide that included the medical bills covered by the MPC?
I'm saying he certainly didn't need to, and I think State Farm made it clear to him that he didn't need to. He went ahead and did it anyway, and I think he did so with the idea in mind that if he did that, then he could claim a right to a one-third contingent fee for the medical payments coverage piece of that, really by doing very little work. The same things that he was submitting, medical bills, medical records, and the medical records for the pre-existing injury, are all records and documents that he had to submit anyway in order to support his client's tort claim against the tortfeasor. So I don't think there was any, you know, dedicated or separate action that was taken by Mr. Castle to that inured to the benefit of State Farm that State Farm couldn't and wouldn't have done on its own. The fact of the matter is, in terms of subrogation between carriers, there's very little required in terms of documentation. The carriers tend to, I mean, they look at the medical total, or they may not even get the bills if they've got a total and if liability is clear. So I think State Farm did what it needed to do, and more importantly, I think it did what was recognized by this court or by a panel of this court in Osborne as sufficient to create a position where State Farm was an active beneficiary and not merely a passive beneficiary. Unless there are additional questions, I don't have anything to add to that. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Seaman.
Address that last issue. The question is, when we got State Farm's letter after the fact saying they were going to do a direct claim, he says all we needed to do was just put them on notice that we didn't have to worry about it. I asked them six times, and this is in the record. I asked them by letter six times, can I go settle my case, release the tortfeasor, and not worry about your claim? Is that what you're claiming? Is that you have a direct independent action and I don't have to do anything or worry about anything, so I can just forget about you guys and go settle on my own? I asked them that six times after they finally asserted the claim, after the global negotiations were taking place, and to that question, they remained totally silent. State Farm refused to answer that question. Now, as to the I want to make one point about Espinoza. Espinoza, a case from just 4 years ago, this court said that under the common law, tort claims are not assignable. The only exceptions to that are workers' comp, where there's the statutory assignment, the old PIP law, where there was a statutory assignment, and the federal workers' comp law, where there's a statutory assignment. Absent that, it's not assignable. And so the plaintiff owns the claim, the plaintiff has the obligation to bring the claim, and there can't be a direct line of action. That's what Espinoza says.
Where is there an assignment provision here. I thought we were dealing with...
There's not.
Okay.
That's my point. And so absent, there's no assignment. They're claiming they have the right to a direct cause of action. I'm saying not only is there not an assignment, an assignment, if they had attempted to do one, would have been illegal and unenforceable under the common law, which applies to this case. Lastly, let me just say about this make-whole issue. Mr. Seaman makes this argument about all this terrible things that are going to happen if we have reconsiderations of make-whole and weighing. That's exactly what the Supreme Court did in the Jorgensen case. It decided that that's the way you had to do it. And why? All plaintiffs, reasonably, are going to discount their settlements for all kinds of problems. Contributory negligence, fault of third parties, causation. They're concerned about that, and the plaintiff should not bear that only burden. Subrogated insurers should have to bear that burden of those problems as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Castle. Thank you again, Mr. Seaman. We appreciate both of your arguments this afternoon. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.